And now getting back to today's news, ISIS attacks in Brussels. Of course, still chaos in the first days of Europe's new immigration policy in Greece. The president plays for high stakes on his visit to Cuba, and we're just about halfway through the presidential primaries. There is a lot to talk about this morning with news analyst Neil Conan. He joins us now, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. And Neil, good morning. The news is still coming in from Brussels, but there seems to be no reason to doubt that this is another series of attacks by ISIS, that same group who carried out the attacks in Paris just 4 months ago.
Yes, good morning, Beth. And it certainly does seem that these attacks today, you know, follow the arrest of Salah Abdeslam, the would-be suicide bomber who apparently changed his mind in Paris back in November, then escaped to Brussels and hid out there ever since. He was arrested in the same neighborhood where he grew up, the same neighborhood where he helped plot the attacks in Paris. According to his lawyer and to the authorities, he said he and his confederates were planning new attacks, and the fact that he was talking or reported to be talking may have prompted the attacks today.
This is also raising all kinds of questions about how many more ISIS members there could be in Europe, about how they've been able to hide, about the effectiveness of the police, even about how the EU and Belgium will respond.
Yeah, Prime Minister Faust said today, we are at war, all of Europe is at war. You know, that's the same statement that French President Hollande used last October. Now, France, in response, stepped up aerial attacks on ISIS in Syria, though we've not heard a lot about that lately. It's unclear what a much smaller country like Belgium could do, or whether the EU or Europe, as Prime Minister Valls tried to rally them, would respond. But we also have to remember that these attacks in Europe, you know, in Paris, now in Brussels, you know, these are horrible incidents, but they're news because they're unusual, because we have a fair amount of transparency into the investigations, because of our identification, many of us, with Europe. We don't hear so much when these scenes happen in Syria and in Iraq and in Lebanon and in Turkey. They happen much more frequently there, of course. Even when the most recent attack in Ankara just this week, this was in a tourist area, and some of those killed were U.S.-Israeli dual nationals.
We keep coming back to Syria in our conversations, both the conflict itself and certainly the spillover, which you're right, you can see all over Twitter, and millions of refugees are fleeing for their lives.
Last week you mentioned the anniversary, that this war had started 5 years ago. Here's another number. Syria was a country of 20 million when this started. It's thought that half of them have now been forced to leave their homes. 10 million people, many, of course, still inside Syria, displaced internally, but millions are in refugee camps in Jordan and in Lebanon and especially in Turkey.
Which rather puts this flow of hundreds of thousands into Europe into some context, and many more are in camps just across Syria's borders.
Absolutely right. And you know, that deal between Turkey and the European Union, which we talked about earlier, it just went into effect yesterday. Absolute chaos thus far, but the crucial part of the deal is that theoretically everyone who tries to reach Greece by what they're calling irregular methods, illegally, coming across from Turkey by boat, everyone will be sent back. For every Syrian sent back, Europe agrees to take in a Syrian refugee from one of those camps on the border, someone who went through the process of applying for asylum in an orderly way.
Yeah, an orderly and legal way. So if there's no reason for migrants to believe that they can eventually get to Germany or perhaps Sweden, there should also be no reason to risk that trip, is sort of the idea behind it, you know, with people who are smugglers and taking them in small boats across the Aegean. Yeah?
That's exactly the idea. But there are major, major problems with this. For example, under international law, if people arrive in Greece and ask for asylum, those cases have to be heard. You're not allowed by law just to, you know, send them back later the same day. And there's nothing like the number of, you know, judges and courts and all the associated bureaucracy to do this. There's no place for those people to live while their cases are heard. And this also leaves a whole lot of people out. Only some of these migrants are Syrians. There are, you know, Iraqis and Afghans and Somalis and Eritreans and a whole bunch of other nationalities. So what happens to them? And there are also 10 to 15,000 refugees of all nationalities who got to Greece before this deal took effect. They're mostly up on the Macedonian border. That border has been blocked, so they can't go forward. They don't want to go back. What happens to them? This is just a complete mess.
For the moment, I just want to leave that because I want to ask you about President Obama's trip to Cuba right now. He's at a ball game in Havana, the Cuban national team against the Tampa Bay Rays. He and his family have been touring the old city. They attended a state dinner. And, of course, yesterday, the president had a meeting with Raul Castro. What do you make of this?
Not just a meeting with Raul Castro, where apparently they talked frankly. That's diplomatese for we had an argument. But they also had a news conference, which was really interesting. You know, the dictator of Cuba forced to take questions from independent reporters. This never happens. And one of them, somebody with Cuban ties from CNN, asked him about political prisoners in Cuba. And for that moment, just at that moment, you know, that mask of diplomacy slipped, and you could see rage on Raul Castro's face, you know, at the, you know, the effrontery, the indignity of being publicly held to account. And it was the moment that, you know, sort of symbolized the risks, I think, the president is taking with this opening to Cuba. How will American business and tourism and, you know, and all the rest change this country? Will it become more open and less repressive? Can an aged and brittle communist leadership adjust, or is it going to crack down like we saw with the arrests of dissidents you know, the day before the president arrived? Now, Cuba has no choice. It has to change. There's no Soviet Union to prop it up anymore. There's no oil subsidies from Venezuela. They're going to be ending soon. It has to come to terms with the United States one way or another. It has to make the transition from the Castros to new leadership. But change doesn't necessarily always mean change for the better. And what Cuba looks like 5 years from now is going to be an important part of how we view the Obama presidency down the road.
Okay, 5 years from now, though, Barack Obama's successor may be in his or her second term. A quick review of where the nominating process stands now before I'll let you go. As we mentioned, we're just about halfway through, right?
Yeah, and I think last Tuesday's results are going to prove to have been decisive. Hillary Clinton won all five states, three of them by very big margins. She's up by more than 300 pledged delegates, and you can see her campaign begin to shift away from the primaries and Bernie Sanders and towards Donald Trump and the general election come November.
Not good news for the Sanders campaign, but is some of this premature? I mean, Sanders says there are a lot of states he thinks he can still win in the West starting today.
Yep, he should win the caucuses in Idaho and Utah today, and he should win those big. It's harder to tell about Arizona. There's not been much polling. The last polls we saw had Secretary Clinton up by double digits, maybe 20 points. Now, we've seen that hold up in Ohio. We've seen that fade away rapidly in Michigan. But in any case, it looks like that's going to be at least close enough. Split the delegates. Again, Bernie Sanders can't be affording to split races very much. But in any case, down the road, he hopes to do very well in places like Washington State and Wisconsin. And here in Hawaii, there have been a few ads on the air, you may have noticed. That's coming up on Saturday for the Democrats. But it's hard to overstate the depth of the hole that he's in. He would have to win about 60% of all the delegates from here on out. We saw President Obama tell Democratic fundraisers a few days ago that, you know, it's time to start wrapping this thing up. Just this week, progressive champion Senator Elizabeth Warren started a Twitter war with Donald Trump. Her mind is on November, and you know, for Democrats, the prospect of candidate Trump is getting pretty persuasive.
The Stop Trump movement in the Republican Party doesn't seem to have coalesced, though.
No, it hasn't at all. And he looks set to win big in Arizona today. That's a winner-take-all state. He will lose in Utah. He is decidedly unpopular among Mormons and did not help himself by attacking Mitt Romney's faith the other day. The question in Utah is 50%. If Ted Cruz gets over 50%, he gets all of Utah's delegates. If he's under 50%, the split is proportional. And then Donald Trump gets that much harder to stop.
So do you think he's going to get that magic number of delegates, the number he needs to win the nomination, that, what, 1237?
Probably. It could be close, but probably he will. And what happens to the Republican Party at that point is anybody's guess. But if you want to get an idea of what a candidate Trump or President Trump might be like, I urge you to read the transcript of his meeting yesterday with the editorial board of the Washington Post. It's available online, or you can listen to it, too, if you want. At several points, you know, it ranges from delusional to incoherent.
I'm glad you said that.
There's a scary moment where he's asked whether he would use tactical nuclear weapons against ISIS. And he declines, you know, he sort of fudges an answer. And he's asked again, you know, what about this? And he turns around and instead of answering, he says, hey, you know, what a beautiful bunch of people we have here. Would you introduce yourselves? This is scary, and it's not the first time he's been scary about nuclear weapons. If you remember, in one of the early debates, he was asked, you know, which part of the nuclear triad would he prioritize in modernization? And the answer that he gave made it absolutely clear he had no clue what the nuclear triad is. You know, the basis of the United States' strategic nuclear posture. His ignorance, his demagogue. It's overwhelming. It's really scary. It makes me wish we'd get back to that ball game in Havana.
All right, then I'm going to let you do that. So what's the score? Do you know?
Last time I checked, it was nothing. Still in the first inning, though. But I assume they've moved on since then.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. But I'll talk to you next week. Thanks a lot, Neil.
You bet that, Ann.
News analyst Neil Conan joins us most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio.